We are a small but select group today, folks, and we are going to assemble my dream machine. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to yet another edition of ITE 1 Class 1, Chapter 3, Computer Assembly. And as I said, we're assembling my grunter. It's my money, no object dream machine, and I hope you've all got it in front of you, because we are going to be asking questions and looking at it, you know, throughout and putting it together and possibly drooling over it. Well, I am anyway. You can if you want. Okay, but we're going to try and do it in a logical, methodical manner, just like Cisco wants us to do. So first, let's prepare. What do we need, folks? Tell me, hit me with it. What equipment do we need?
We need our toolkit to start with.
Yep, what else?
A case.
Case.
Yeah, we're talking about equipment. What equipment are we after at the moment? You know, what sort of things do we need to in order to do that?
We need our wrist strap and our mat and our screwdrivers and a bench space.
Yeah, preferably a clean one. And also hand sanitizer would be a good thing, just so you don't get to keep those excess oils out of components, because as blind techs as we are, we have to do a bit more touching than Cisco and computer people generally are happy with. But that's just the way it is. So are we all ready?
Kylie, did you say we were all working on the same system?
Yep, you've restored your audio, yep. Whatever you did.
Open the case. That was the first thing we're going to do. This case is a Li & Li PCP80, and Li & Li cases tend these days to be more and more toolless. My old one has a few screws, but let's just say this is toolless, and we'll undo it. Now, there are several ways to open cases, and you really do need to consult the manual as to which way to do it. This manual was a bit hard to get to because it was in a RAR file, and the PDF inside was corrupt. But never mind, there are various ways to open cases, and they are. You can remove the cover as one piece. The top and side panels of the case can be removed, or the top of the case may need to be removed before the side panels can be removed. This has got a top-mounted power supply, so I guess we won't be removing the whole top, because we'll have to install the power supply in the top rear. So, now our case is open. We have heaps of bays in here and lots of room for all this good stuff. Have we attached our straps to the unpainted portion of the case?
Hope so.
I hope so too, because the next is this grunter of a power supply. Can anyone tell me what form factor the power supply is going to need to be?
Depends on what the case is.
Yes, and if you have the specs in front of you, you'll know exactly what the power supply is or what it's designed for. This case is an XL80X form factor, which is an oversized ATX, really. So a power supply, ATX, XL80X, E80X, anything like that will do. This one, how many watts is it?
1,000.
Yep, it's a grunter, all right. Okay, so who wants to insert the power supply? Who can tell me how to do that? Yes, John.
Where are you looking? I do not have what you are referring to.
Kylie sent us an email, yes.
I got an email.
In that email I said, bring it to lecture.
Okay, I'll look there. Apparently I didn't read thoroughly.
Okay, Kate, how are we going to insert the power supply? How do we do that?
I would position the power supply probably in the top back corner of the case and fasten the screws.
Fantastico! Excellent! All right, the power supply is in place and we still have room for heaps of things because it's such a bloody big case. Okay, the next thing is we're going to install the motherboard, and first it's easier to put the components onto the motherboard and install the whole thing rather than try to put RAM and other stuff on the motherboard. It's just easier while you've got the motherboard flat in front of you. So we are going to put the motherboard on a mat beside us, take it out of its lovely anti-static bag. What components are we going to put on it, people? Exactly. Okay. That's exactly what we're going to do. Right. Now, you need full anti-static rig for this, of course, because these are all particularly sensitive components. So just make sure that you've grounded, just to be sure. Now, it says don't touch the contacts, but as blind people, we need to do a little bit of feeling around. Now, with these new modern sockets, you will find the pins are inside the socket on the motherboard, not on the CPU, which makes it a tad tricky. So we're just going to have to be really careful here. There's a locking assembly that secures it, the heat sink, and there's a ZIF socket that secures the CPU to the motherboard. Now, as I said, you've got to be really familiar with these things before you put them in. We may need thermal compound, although it's possible that in this day and age these things are impregnated with thermal compound. But if you were putting together a used PC that you'd serviced, you would want to clean off the heatsink with what, people, before you installed new compound? There's only one thing you clean insides of computers with as far as actually contact with the components. It's the same thing you clean RAM with. What's that?
A lint-free cloth?
No, you want to use a swab or a cotton bud for this. And anyone else want to have a go?
Oh, that special alcohol stuff.
Yeah, isopropyl alcohol, not rubbing alcohol. It's got to be isopropyl. So if you were using if you're putting together an old machine, you would clean off the heatsink with isopropyl, and then you would put the compound on it. Okay, now that we have got all our ducks in a row, we can put things together. You need both the heatsink and the fan, as well as the CPU. So let's put it in there. Who's going to tell me how to put the CPU in? Not you, Kate, someone else. How about someone else having a go at this? Kim, how about you?
We're here. She took a bathroom break, sorry.
Okay. John, are you there?
John is here, and Kylie, I apologize. I do not have that attachment. But anyway, the way if I went to order a CPU, I would be sure that it was the same socket before I started, and then I would feel for something to key off of on the CPU itself. And it's, I believe, what do they call it? Zero insertion force. So it's very sensitive.
Exactly right. Okay, now once the CPU is in place, there are two things we have to do. Can anyone tell me what they are?
Again, on this CPU that I'm pretending to have in my mind's eye, you would fasten it to the motherboard through whatever the screws are that come with it.
No, a CPU doesn't have screws. It's got two things, could I? Anyone else?
The one that I've had a look at has got two little niches in the side of it, as well as a cut-off corner, and so you would align pin 1 with the CPU with pin 1 on the socket and seat it so that the little niches on the side fit in the correct place. Then the one that I've seen has got a little door that you fold over it, and then a lever that you pull over to lock it in.
That's what I was looking for, Kate, the load plate and the load lever. That's what they're called, and you may be tested on that, so it's best to be aware. You close the load plate once you've seated it, and if you haven't seated it properly and close that load plate, you will bend the pins and it's goodbye CPU, and then lock the lever in place. As I said, they're test alerts, so it is important to remember those. Now that we've got our CPU in place, if we need to, we'll apply a small amount of thermal compound to the CPU and spread it evenly. And we read the manual for all these things just to make sure we're doing it right. RTFM again, always RTFM. Okay, how do we install the heatsink fan assembly, everybody? Okay, it has retainers and they need to be aligned to the holes on the motherboard. And then you place it onto the CPU socket, being very careful not to pinch the CPU fan wires. Tighten the heatsink fan assembly retainers to secure the assembly in place. Then you need to connect the lower power cable to the header on the motherboard. And you are done. We have now got the CPU and heatsink installed. And the next thing is what, people? What else do we want on the motherboard before we stick it in the case?
We put on the RAM.
Okay, and how do we make sure the RAM is compatible with the motherboard?
It tells you in the manual, but I don't know if that's the correct answer.
It does, John. That is the correct answer. The motherboard manual actually tells you quite a lot about what you need, what it likes to live with and what it doesn't. So, it's always a good idea to read the motherboard manual when you're installing a new machine, especially from scratch. Okay.
And I noticed that this one's got DDR3 RAM.
It does. It's triple channel RAM, which is kind of cool, really. It's very new. I've been a little bit conservative. We're only sticking in 6 gigs here and 2 gig sticks, 3 of them, into the 6 slots. Okay, so now we have our RAM sorted out. How do we install it, please? Are you there, Kim?
No, I'm back. Had a rather long bathroom break. Sorry about that.
How do we install RAM?
Well, hold on. Can people hear me?
Perfectly.
Okay. You line up the notches and it should click in there.
Yeah. Do you want to be a bit more specific?
There's latches and you push them and they click. I haven't taken my memory out for a while. I should.
Okay. There's a little notch in them and they all have different notches in different places depending on what type of module they are. So you want to align that with the keys in the slot. Now, there are several ways to put RAM in up the right way as a blind person. You could, one of your classmates who actually can't attend lectures actually wrote to me and suggested this, that you can just put the RAM module in, and if it rocks, if it doesn't actually feel secure, it's not the right way up. That's actually a good way if you don't want to put your finger in the slot. But if you've got a clean finger and you've got your sanitizer with you, you can make sure you do have a clean finger. Stick your finger in there, feel where the notch is, and feel gently where the notch is on your RAM and align the two of them. That probably, I think, is the easiest and more efficient way of doing it. Now, if you give it a wriggle and it's not locked securely in place, you need to have another go and make sure it is before you close the tabs over the ends. And your memory should all be in place. And we're going to have to do that 2 more times so that we have our 3 lots of 2 gig sticks in there. Are we all, is everyone keeping up so far?
I have a question. Is it, as far as the memory goes, would it be better to have 6 gigs in terms of 3 lots of 2, or would it be better if you had a 4 gig stick and a 2 gig? What do you think?
I don't know that it makes much difference. There are 6 slots in this motherboard, so we filled 3 of them, not the 3 contiguous slots, mind you. We usually have a slot between each. That's traditional. But you could fill all of them with 4 gig sticks to have up to 24 gigs on this motherboard, according to the specs.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, contiguous.
A comment, Kylie.
Go ahead, John.
I wasn't aware that if you're adding RAM, to be sure that that all the RAM is the same speed, because if you add a slower RAM, your RAM is going to default, all your RAM is going to default to that lower speed.
Yes, that would be right. So you want the RAM to all be the same speed. That's just, I think traditionally sometimes people put different sorts of RAM in there, but yeah, you really do want matching modules. Okay, now if you feel the motherboard, we have got the CPU installed, we've got the heatsink assembly there, and we have the RAM. We're ready to stick it into the case, and that isn't actually a mean feat as a blind person, I've found, because there's a lot of aligning to do, and with such a big motherboard and such a big case, it's going to be a challenge. But there are little, and I think they're square, the ones I've seen are square, things called standoffs, and they're plastic or metal, and they fit into holes in the back of the case. So what you're going to do is put those into the holes, into their matching holes, all of them, but only the ones that go into the holes, into the back of the case first. And the term standoff is another important thing, because it's also something that you may be tested in. So we install the standoffs in the back of the case. Then the next challenge is what, people? Can you think of what the next challenge might be? It's more aligning before we start screwing it in.
Yeah, well, you need to try and align all of the ports with the back of the case and get the motherboard sitting correctly on the standoffs. I tried to do this with a motherboard the other day, and I ended up actually laying the case on its side so that the motherboard was laying down, which made it easier for me to manipulate it into place.
Yep, and I think that would probably be the easiest way, Kate, to do that, because trying to hold the thing and then, you know, because it doesn't actually, it's not stable while it's held in there until you do the next thing, which is add your screws, can be a bit difficult, especially with such a big bugger like this, because you also need to align the screw holes with the standoffs and then stick all the screws in. So let's hold our mouth right as well as our hands and see if we can do that. We'll stick all the screws in, and the motherboard should be well secured to the back of the case with all the components in place. Are we all here so far?
Yes, but I want to ask a question.
Yeah, go ahead. You don't have to wait for me to give you permission. Just ask.
When you buy a case, I've looked at two different types of motherboards, and the configurations of the sockets and I/O slots on the motherboard, both of them are quite different. So when you buy a case, how do you organize the case? What do you have to do to organize the case to make all of those I/O slots fit correct places on the so that they poke out the right hole?
Well, if the case is compatible with the motherboard, that should happen. This case I chose from the supported chassis list on the website, so I would hope that would be the case. Have you got anything to add there, Eve?
I've got a severe latency problem. I'm actually still listening to Kate ask her question, and she's coming over the top of your live version, so I'll just wait for Kate to run out.
What's your ping there?
42, but I did plug a network cable into the system at the same time Kate was talking. Maybe it gave Enterprise a jolt. Okay, now it's all up to date. Let's find out what Kylie's question was to me. Sorry, Kylie, go ahead.
Kate was asking about how would you organise the motherboard to align in the openings in the case. How would you know that the case you've chosen would actually do that? And I answered that if you choose a case that's on the supported cases list of the motherboard manufacturer, that should work. Have you got anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I pretty much agree with that. Supported cases list, and most of those with the ATX form factory, as long as the case is large enough, would work anyway. And it's like lining up screws and stuff. You just make sure that, you sort of get very, very good with your dexterity and make sure there's enough standoffs and holes as what there are on the motherboard. Line one up first loosely, start putting it together, and then do the diagonal one.
Mentioning is that all these cases... it's Dina from South Africa. I'm just listening in. But one of the other things that is important is that a lot of these cases actually have expansion slots which you can actually remove so that you can get the motherboards to actually fit into the ATX cases. And generally, most ATX cases would fit an ATX motherboard.
Exactly.
Yes, in this case, we're using a Super Tower case and an XL ATX motherboard. So we're dealing with a monster here. Okay, so now that we've got ourselves all lined up, we have to screw the screws into the standoffs now. You were saying something about that, a line-up diagonal. Do you want to be a bit more specific? Because this could be helpful when people are assembling the computer.
It's like with putting anything together. Start one off loosely, and then sort of don't do them all up too tight. It gives you a bit of play to be able to make sure the other holes match up. Same as putting hard drives in. I never do the first screw up super tight until I've got one or two others in anyway. So let you play a bit.
Yeah, I usually do that too when I'm putting something together, is just do them all up loosely just to get them positioned and then tighten them up afterwards.
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
Any helpful tips about the order in which you should do these things? I'm not a particularly dexterous person, so...
Not really.
It could be.
Not in the case of another board, no.
But I like your idea, Elise, of doing a diagonal or perhaps two on the top or two down one side so that you've got something that's going to make it fairly stable while you look for and fiddle with the rest.
That's it, exactly. Yep. You haven't been putting IKEA furniture together, have you, Kate?
Much of it, very much of it.
Oh, you're lucky.
We don't
you can
have IKEA
get it together.
Here, unfortunately. I wish we did.
Well, yes, but there again, you might go nuts reading the instructions anyway. That's another story.
Oh, I don't know.
I never read the instructions. That's my problem.
You probably got the thing together quicker than the person who did.
Yeah, probably did too. Actually, Deb and my sister and I have got quite good at putting stuff together. This computer desk. There's a case in point. It was a kit, and we got quite adept at between the two of us at sticking stuff together and screwing it all in and puzzling out which bit should go with what. Anyway, now that we have our motherboard installed, we've got hard drives to deal with. Now, one of the reasons I chose two drives is because we need to talk about what happens if you're using an older machine, because the situation is quite different with this modern monster that you have in front of you. Okay, what we've got is a nice little 90 gig SSD drive for our OS and apps, and a nice 2 TB magnetic green drive for our data, lots of data. Okay, now, it's important to remember that an internal drive An internal bay is something which lives completely inside the computer. So an internal bay is something which lives completely inside the case. And a hard disk drive is an internal drive in this case. Right. Now, if we were installing the modern drives, it's that they install in much the same way in terms of the physical way they go in. Can someone tell me what they're going to do to install these? And they'll install in the same way. Kim, how about you?
Well, you could put the drive into the drive bay and then screw your four screws into the, what the hell are they called, the brackets, and hopefully it'll stay there.
Yeah, what size drive bay should the drive go into?
We're 3.5 inch. External.
We're talking internal. About the internal one, and it goes in the 3.5 inch bay.
Yeah, and you're correct, Kate. It's a 3.5 inch internal bay. So we align, we stick the drive in, align the holes in the drive up with the holes in the bay, and screw it in, and it's in there. Now, if you were using an older machine, there'd be something else you'd have to check before you put the drive in. On older machines, on EIDE drives, you would need to set the jumpers, especially if you're using a secondary drive, as we're doing here. Now, it doesn't say too much about jumpers in the notes. It actually doesn't say enough, in my opinion, but as far as I remember, they're tiny, teeny little lugs that you have to set, and that tells you what drive is for which purpose. So your solid-state drive, or the primary drive in this case, would be set to be the master, and the secondary drive would be set to slave. Have you got anything to add on jumpers, E?
Yes, I have. I'm not sure that you'll see too many PATA solid-state drives around. You'll probably see SATA ones, and with the SATA technology, you don't need to worry about jumpers. Yay!
Exactly. Actually, no, you do if you're using an older machine.
None of the solid-state drives that I've seen are PATA drives. They're all SATA drives, actually.
Yeah, that's cool. But we need to. If you were putting together an old machine, you may have to set jumpers if you're using a secondary drive.
Just wouldn't bother. I mean, say the motherboards are too fast. I mean, so they'll run it and they support it. The BIOS, and we'll get to the BIOS a bit later because there's a very good lab that we were listening to on the weekend that was done by the people back at Cavi. Is usually set so that you can accept an IDE or a PATA drive. Or set of PATA drives, but if you're putting together a new machine, you'd be buying SATA now and you wouldn't have to worry. And you'd just leave it in compatibility mode for if you want to put in an extra drive, but I certainly wouldn't make my master drive the IDE or PATA. I'd be going SATA.
Yeah, but not everyone is necessarily going to be putting together a new machine. We're doing it in this exercise, but it may be that you come across an older machine, as I did. I did my disassembly on a new machine, but I put together an older machine. Which gave me good exposure to both sorts of cables and other things. So, yeah, just be aware that you need to fiddle with jumpers if you're dealing with IDE and PATA.
So okay. What I guess you're trying to get to is that when you're doing your PATA drive, your main drive goes at the end of your PATA cable, and there's another connector in the centre of your PATA cable, which is your slave drive.
Yep, that's exactly right. And we were going to get to that down the line a bit when we talk about connecting internal cables. But yes, that is the case, and you'd need to set the jumpers on both. But as Dina and Elise pointed out, if you're using a modern machine, it's SATA, and you don't have to worry about any of that, which makes life oh so much easier.
I think the only thing you haven't got to yet, Kali, is that when you get to optical drives, especially some of the CD-ROMs and so on that are still around there, those are PATA drives, and you'd have to set the jumpers then.
Yes, and optical drives are next on the list. We're doing everything.
Having said that, though, I do actually have a SATA CD optical drive in my current computer, so you're right. I've got two machines here, one I'm fixing for my auntie. It has a parallel ATA optical drive, and it's the same vintage, a little bit newer than my machine, but my machine actually has a SATA one there. At least I can think. I can pull the side off and quickly check if you want.
Yeah, you do get both at the moment. Yeah,
yeah, I'm pretty sure it had a SATA connector on. I think that's much attention.
Yeah, that's where it comes down to, you know, when you're actually picking your motherboard as to how many SATA connectors, sockets you have, and how many IDE sockets and so on, and sort of, you know, which you want to go for.
Yeah, exactly. The motherboard in this particular machine is actually newer than the rest of it because of a certain lightning strike that Carly knows about last year. So we just got something better than the rest of the machine in this case.
Okay, and on our modern Dream machine here that we are using, everything is SATA, so we don't have to worry about that. But yes, it was good to point out that, Dina, we need to set jumpers on a PATA optical drive. Now, an optical drive goes in an external bay, and that is one which lives in the computer case but allows access to the drive without opening the case. And these include both floppy and optical drives. So it's called an external bay if you can access it from outside the case without actually having to open the case. Are we all clear on that?
All clear.
Okay. Now, of course, an optical drive is what, people? Remind me, somebody.
You've got a beautiful Blu-ray one here.
Yes, and what's an optical drive do, people?
Reads optical media.
It helps me reinstall my... Oh, sorry.
It can use it to reinstall your OS if it all craters, can't you?
It's for reading and writing media like CDs, DVDs, Blu-rays and that sort of stuff.
And it does that using... Lasers. Okay.
Oh, yes, that's now, the one. That's I couldn't think what those things were.
Now, in our old, if we were putting together an older machine with PATA drives again, what would be the name of the power connector for our hard drive PATA drive and our older optical PATA drive?
The power connector would be a MOLLE.
Yes, and the data cable has how many pins?
40.
Yeah, it does. That is cool. Okay, of course, modern, it's SATA, and the power connector for a SATA is how many pins? Anyone?
7.
Actually, it's 15. It's 7 for the data. So it's 15 for power, 7 for data. I always used to get that really confused. They actually look really similar, and they usually fit next to each other from my experience. And they're only tiny, a little bit different in size, so that's... Actually, they're quite hard to install, too, I find, because they're so close to each other, and they're an angled, sort of an L shape. Okay. So, what size bay are we going to put our optical drive, our nice Blu-ray player in here?
I'd put it in one of the 5.25 external drive bays.
Okay, and we install it in the same way as we do the hard drive. So what do we do, folks? John, I haven't heard from you for a while. Earth John?
Just
is John
little
still here?
Note on SATA whenever you're ready, Carly.
Yep, you can go ahead now. We don't seem to be getting an answer from John.
Right. With SATA, the power and data connectors are next to each other, and so much so that I think Will told me that part of the spec with SATA is that they have to be exactly in the same place, so that whilst you're in this context talking about plugging them in with plugs on the end of cables, is that when the SATA connector is mounted on the back of a hard drive pod, or where you put a removable hard drive in, or in my case, the dock, where I do a lot of work on hard drives that are not mounted in machines, you can just plug it straight in and they both connect in the one hit.
Yes,
same thing can be said for the hard drive. Yep, same thing can be also said for the hard drive in most SATA laptops, i.e. the one I changed a week or two ago, where you just mount the hard drive on a tray and slide the tray in and it connects both power and data together. Yes, remember that? Yep, and they just both, once you push the tray back with the hard drive mounted correctly on it, so that as long as your screws are all lined up, your hard drive's going to sit on the right part of the tray. You just gently push the tray back and you'll hear a bit of a click, and both data and power are connected, and then you just, screw the rest of the machine back together and you're done.
That's why I like laptops.
And apart from Jackie's being a nuisance to get the bits, it's exactly how it went back together when I was in Phoenix.
Okay, so we now have a case with our motherboard with its components on it and all our drives installed except for the floppy. Now, this particular machine we're using doesn't have a floppy, so let's just run over what are the connectors for a floppy drive, power and data.
34-pin floppy drive PATA for the data and a Berg connector for the power.
Good one, Kate. And it installs in the same way. What you can do with the external drives, of course, is take the front faceplate off. So you can install it through the front of the case instead of through the top. It just makes it a hell of a lot easier to push it in that way and align it. that's what you do. You position the FDD so that it aligns with the what size bay? What size are we putting the 3.5 in the floppy? 3.5 inch. I just said it. Floppy goes in the 3.5 inch external bay. Yep. Someone was miking up.
Yeah. I was doing this machine that I pulled apart when I had no idea what I was doing, pulling apart a machine, and its floppy drive actually installed from internally, and the button that I thought you would normally use to eject the disk was actually inside the machine, but it aligned up with just a little slot on the front of the machine rather than actually...
Don't you just love them?
Oh, it was awful.
Pain in the bloody neck, those things, because there's something more to break.
Yeah, I've seen cases like that, actually. But also the other
smiley
thing
face
is that
on where you put
lots
your
of
floppy
new
disk.
Machines don't even have stiffy drives.
And there's a little trick to when you come to connecting the internal cables of the floppy. We'll talk about that later on when we come to connect all the internal cables. But we have adapter cards to install next. Are we all still here?
Aren't you going to put your card reader in?
Yeah, I've okay, got a nice we'll big card reader from Phoenix, and we put it in. Yeah, bolt that in we'll one, of the, one of the front bays too.
Yeah, we'll put the card reader in. It goes in where, Kate? Tell me. Seeing as how
well,
you found it for us so nice.
Well, it said that it goes in one of the 3.5 inch external bays.
Oh, you've got a little one.
Yeah, it's only a 74 in one. Sorry, it wasn't any better.
No, mine's going. They can vary. You can put them in the 5-inch bays as well. 5 1/4 inch bays as well, if it's big enough, depending on the size of it. So yes, you find the appropriate bay and put it in. You know, external bay obviously because it needs to stick out.
Yeah, it goes
front.
In the same. Yep, goes in the same way as every other drive. Stick it in. Align the screw holes up. And screw it in, using the proper screws, of course, and all of the screws, AE.
Sorry, what was that, Kylie?
Why say that?
I was just digging at you, saying using all of the screws, A.
Ah, yes, I won't tell you how I did my Chapter 2 worksheet when I was a student. Geraldine's no longer here anymore.
You know.
Oh, go on, tell them, it's a bit of a dig.
No, it's a bit of a nuisance. Well, it says in the Chapter 2 worksheet, it goes, oh, when you pull out your CD-ROM or when it pull out your hard drive, it goes, how many screws did you pull out? And I just wrote in there as many as I remembered to put back the last time I had it to bits. Oh, they gave me 100%, so I must have passed the course.
Sorry, Dina, you were saying something.
Yeah, the one thing with card readers, and you get some of these card readers where you have to actually open the top of the card reader out and actually connect the data cable on the inside and then put the cover back over it. And that's one of the sort of units that I've got here, which is a 52 in one card reader.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, so, some of them are a nuisance. You're right, Dina. Mine actually had them on there, but I think you could unplug them and had a heap of cables because you've got the cables for the USB slots, you've got the cable for the eSATA. You've got your audio cable because you've usually got a front mic and front mic and front speakers where I've got my headphones plugged in, which reminds me I better go get another 3.5mm adapter. And on mine you've got, also for the cards themselves because mine does compact flash and SD and one or two others. So there's quite a number of connectors that come out the back of the card reader, depending on the type that you get.
Cool bananas. Okay, so we have all our...
Cisco covering card readers. It's a bit too old now, isn't it?
No, it's not, unfortunately. It should have done so. Thank you for that, Kate. I shall add that to the old Dream Machine specs, and we will install our adapter cards. Now, like drives, they all go in a similar fashion, whatever card they are. They're just a different slot type for whatever they require. Now, in the curriculum here... it wants to deal with a network, an NIC, a wireless, and a video card. But in this particular machine that we're using, it doesn't need an NIC because it's integrated onto the motherboard, and I'm not quite sure why you would put Wi-Fi in a desktop anyway, to be honest. And, of course, we've got a whiz-bang video card to stick in there too. Does anyone know what kind of slot we would put the NIC in if we were going to use one?
either be a PCI or a PCI Express.
These times it would, yep.
Yeah, PCI Express 1, it says here, and you can use some of those many X16 slots to will convert down to other forms of Express card, apparently, according to the manual. Again, good old RTFM, that's the mantra that you always want to fall back on if you're not sure. Read the fine manual. Okay, so to install any adapter card, we do the following. What, people? How do we install an adapter card?
Line it up with the slot and just press gently until it sits into place, because it should, if it's done correctly, it should just push gently into place, and then there's usually a screw to screw it onto the case.
Yep, easy peasy peasy, and you can feel whether it's lined up correctly. It's all nice and flat and straight and neat against the sides of the case there, and just screw it in, and it is done. Okay, now what card type do we need to what we've got a video card here. What type of slot are we going to use for that?
It's a PCI slot.
No, it's not. Anyone else?
It's an AGP. It's an AGP slot.
Oh, that's getting a bit dated too.
Oh boy, I've got an AGP slot on this machine, dear. It's 6.5 years old.
The old AGP these days.
Yeah, I reckon.
That's exciting.
But
so is the slot the NVIDIA slot?
No, PCIe is what you're looking for. PCIe.
IE time X16 is usually the slot where a video card goes.
Video cards, yeah.
And that's where the slot on the specs that we're using here go. It's the PCI X16. And again, we install it by dropping it in. Yep.
I must say, all the motherboards I've got here have got AGP. I must also say... Just like
mine, Adina.
Most of the new motherboards actually have integrated display cards and network and sound cards.
They do, but you find if you get to the high-end ones, they don't always seem to have integrated video, I've found. And this one doesn't have an integrated video card, so
nope.
We would need to install one.
My high-performance motherboard I got in November, after lightning strike, doesn't have integrated video. The top-end ones don't.
And being a bit of an audio buff, I would probably want to install a sound card. We're not doing it for this exercise, but I probably would want to install one anyway, because I'm just like that, you know. Broadcasting can be very expensive in terms of the equipment and things and toys that you want, because microphones and sound cards and things get rather pricey. So, yeah, I've rather been led astray, I think, unfortunately.
Well, I'm just like you, Kylie, because I generally put in two sound cards in each machine so that I've got speech running through one and all my audio stuff running through the other one.
Yeah, I find JAWS tends to behave better if you do that. It gets a bit silly when it has to share, unfortunately.
I was gone for a while. I had to go to Yahoo to get that attachment, so if anybody called on me, I was gone.
That's okay, John. We'll make sure you answer your share of questions now. You're back. Welcome back. And I think we have someone called Catherine here. Welcome in, Catherine. I'm sorry, I didn't notice you there just before. Welcome in. And I might actually have had to rope you in as well. You've been very quiet sitting in the background there.
Well, I'm actually not in this class. I'm just here observing what it's like. I actually build computers. I've been doing it for several years.
Oh, well, feel free to chime in just as Dina is doing. He's also in your class, so feel free to chime in. You're most welcome. We're trying to be as interactive as possible today. We're building this grunt of an imaginary machine that's got a super tower case and an XL80X motherboard and an Extreme i7 Intel processor. It's got the whole sort of works. It's my sort of dream machine, money no object type thing. We're imagining putting all that together, and we have now reached the stage where we can connect the internal cables. We are making progress, folks. So please feel free to chime in whenever you like.
Yeah, okay. One thing I always have trouble with is the alignment, putting in the board, and because you have to know where to put the standoffs and what holes, and then put the board in. That's the only thing that I have trouble with, but everything else I can pretty much do.
And have you got any tips for how you do that alignment, Catherine, that we haven't already covered? Because it's always handy to, you know, for other blind techies who are doing this to have tips on how people do it, because we do have to do things a little bit differently.
No, I would like some. Somebody suggested a stylus so you could feel where the holes are first, and then you kind of remember where the holes are, so you can put the standoffs in and then and put the then align the board. But if there are any other ways to do it, I would, you know, welcome them.
I think a word of caution here, Kelly, is that if you're using a stylus, don't use it on the motherboard. You might scratch the actual copper circuitry on the motherboard, and it'll short up the board.
Yeah, I get that totally, Dina. I was thinking something like that myself. I was going to say that standoff holes, in my experience, feel a little bit differently to screw holes. Screw holes are usually round, and in my experience, the standoff holes where the actual standoff goes into the case are a different shape. They tend to be sort of more squarish, and the standoffs just actually pop into those. So they're just something that you kind of just click in.
Yeah, right, but sometimes there are more of the standoff holes because the case is designed for different boards, for example.
Actually, you know, the other method, and I've got quite a few cases here that actually does that, where you can actually remove the whole base plate. And you then mount the motherboard on that separate to the actual chassis, and then you just mount the whole base plate back in, and everything lines up perfectly then.
Hey, that's pretty cool. I don't suppose you can do that with every case, though, can you?
I'm sure it just depends on the case that you're actually buying. It's just fortunate I picked the cases that I wanted.
That might be something you have to consider as a blind techie if you're building your own machine, is to pick the kind of case that would be the most suitable for you to work with. And I think we talked a little bit like that in maybe lecture one or lecture two in chapter one. I think we mentioned that in passing anyway. So it's an important thing to note. Pick cases that are going to be most suitable for you. Hey, that's really neat. I'd never heard of that. Okay, so now we have all of our components installed, and we need to connect them up to power and to data sources. And of course, power cables are used to distribute electricity from the power supply to the motherboard and other components, and data cables transmit the data between the motherboard and the storage drives, such as the hard drive. And you need additional cables to connect the buttons and link lights on the front of the computer case to the motherboard. Now, as a person with hand problems as well as being blind, I'd have a little bit of difficulty with that, because tiny things don't get on well with me at all. But let's get to that. The power cables come first. The motherboard power cable is what, people?
You've got a 20 plus 4.
Yes, that will be a 20 plus 4 auxiliary, I think, by the look of it. But a 20-pin will work in a 24-pin socket. For me, I'd connect the auxiliary anyway, because it's harder to tell whether you'll need it or not. So just plug it in to save time. I had that problem when I was doing my assembly last year. We had a bit of a debate about whether we should put the auxiliary in. We didn't, found we needed it, and we had to go through and plug it in. So it's better to do it, I think, if it's there. If it's got a socket there, stick it in. Okay, and it's just a matter, really, of, it goes into a big spiel about how to align these things, but it's just, you know, plug it into the connector and don't force it, just, it can only go one way. It's got a little clip on it, And you do the same with the auxiliary connector. Now be aware, screen reader users, that auxiliary, A-U-X, may be pronounced as O. So just that's a weird trap for young players there. It's A-U-X, but JAWS, at least, calls it O. JAWS is trying to be French and sophisticated and not doing it very well, but there we are.
Could always do what I did the other day when it wouldn't read CMOS properly and change the pronunciation in the JAWS dictionary.
Yeah, you could do that, but you need to be aware of what it's going to tell you first, I think. And, you know, sometimes that can be a bit confusing for people. To think, what the hell is O connector? Well, it's actually AUX. So there we are. Okay, now a SATA power connector is how many pins, people? We have plugged our motherboard connector in. Now, SATA power is next, and how many pins is that?
40.
SATA That's was 15, wasn't it?
Yep.
Oh, SATA.
SATA.
Okay,
yeah. You know, SATA is 15, and now PATA is actually you were thinking the data cable anyhow. If we were installing older hard drives and optical drives in there, it would be a what, John? What power
40 pins.
Connection would be? No, that's the data. Well, data. Sorry, what power? What's the power connection for the older drives?
I just took it off the other day. I'm blank. I'm bankrupt.
It starts with an M.
Molex.
That's Molex.
Yeah.
Molex. That's right.
And it has a 4-pin. Connector. So if we were assembling an older machine here with PATA drives and even a PATA optical drive, we would be using a Molex connector to connect up the power. Okay. Now, again, it's just a matter, these are keyed connectors, and so you are just going to put them in, not force them, and they should align and slip in reasonably easily. But you need to be careful with hard drives to not use a Molex connector and a SATA power connector on the same drive at the same time. I'm not quite sure what happened, but I don't think it would be nice. So basically, plug your power connectors. No, actually, I haven't either. I'm not quite sure why they put that in there.
Crazy.
Maybe just to make one of those other weirdly worded questions that we can get wrong.
There you go. Don't you just love Uncle Cisco? Wonderful, weirdly worded questions in your exams. Enjoy, folks.
Oh, there are lots of weirdly worded questions, all right. Okay, if we were going to connect a floppy drive, again, what power connector would we be using?
Can I take a shot at a bird?
Bird connector.
Yay, excellent. It's all right, people. Okay, and there's also a 3-pin fan connector that you have to put it into the appropriate fan head on the motherboard. According to the manual, again, RTFM, good old manual. You can't do without those because you just never know. There might be slight differentiations that happen, and as we go through, you'll see, especially in the printer chapter, actually, where that becomes really important. Okay. You need to plug in the link lights into their various ports, and they're tiny little wee fiddly wires. I'm not quite sure. Has anyone got any tips for doing that? Because they're very tiny, aren't they?
What I want to know is, how do you know which one goes where? Apart from the manual,
yeah,
that is.
I actually had trouble with my last build, and I had to get a friend to tell me where they go. And I had somebody sided label the actual cables for me in Braille, and that's how I plugged them in.
Yeah, that's good, Catherine, because I guess what that's saying really is we have to do a bit more prep, you know, maybe label certain parts of the case, label cables, make sure that we know what's what actually before we start our assembly, because sighted people in particular have to have those activity lights. They're important, and we'll talk a bit more about the floppy disk activity light in a minute when we come to plug in the data cables. which are next on the list. Are we all here so far?
Cool.
I think one of the problems, with putting those lights on is that some of them are color coded, and I've got a unit here where there's no color coding. It's all the same color, so you're never sure what's what. And the one way around it is to actually use a light probe to actually tell you whether the lights are actually on or not.
Well, a light probe worked with such tiny lights like that. I wasn't sure it would be that sensitive. Actually, light probes are hard to get these days.
The one that I've got actually works pretty well.
Oh, that's cool. If you've got one,
you've got to hold it. Yeah, you gotta actually hold it very close up against the case and actually put your hand across it so that you block out light from any other source.
Hey, well, whatever works, that's awesome. I just wish they were more readily available. It's a bit like the old talking multimeters. They're pretty hard to get now too, unfortunately, and they're quite handy to have for a blind person if you want to test the electrical circuits. Okay, data cables.
What are hard to get?
I'm finding light probes quite hard to get. Hello, Dave. Hello.
Hello. Say that again. What?
Light probes. I'm getting pretty hard to come by.
I thought that's what you'd said. It's funny because I've just been talking about those. very good. Carry on.
And talking multimeters. They're the other things that are pretty hard to get these days too. They were for a while there.
Yes, those are pretty well disappeared from the market.
Sort of the other aid that someone else mentioned and they tried was actually using a color detector. And what they did was they laid the cables against a white page, just a blank page, and then used the color detector to then identify which were the different colors.
Cool. I suppose you'd have to have a fairly high quality color detector for that as well, but hey. You know, whatever works, as long as you can get the adaptive gear, cool stuff.
The one that was mentioned was the Colorino. It was the Colorino color detector.
Oh, thanks for that. That's cool. I believe that is a pretty accurate detector. Sorry. Yep.
In all, I think we have. Three different ones, and we've tested them on a number of things, and pretty much all the time, the Colorino will prove to be the most accurate on particularly more difficult colors.
Actually, that's really good to know. I had heard that myself. Anyway, so now we have all of the different aids that we need to connect up the little link lights and wires, although for me, I don't think that being having hand problems is a little bit difficult. I find it very hard to hold tiny wires in my hand without shaking. So anyway, connect those up and we are ready to put our data cables in. Now, this is, of course, the driver being connected determines the type of data cable used. And the types of data cables are people for the hard drives.
IDE or PADA.
I think for your dream machine, those are SATA.
Yes.
The hard drive was a SATA connector, wasn't it?
How come everyone's gone so quiet?
Well, I was starting to wonder the same thing.
Oh, maybe we will get them all talking in a minute. Okay.
Yeah, I must say, we've had the most hideous internet connectivity problems in the last 24 hours, so even our major banks were down, so I wasn't sure if I lost everyone.
Well, it's good to hear that you're still connected and you're coming through loud and clear here, Dennis, so that's awesome. Okay, plugging the powder cables into drives. So we had an older drive, which we don't on this Dream Machine. Kate mentioned it earlier. Who wants to reiterate what Kate said about how you connect multiple hard drives up if you were using PATA? Kate mentioned the two connectors on the PATA cable, one on the end and one on the middle. So which drive goes where, folks? It's something you get tested in your exam, so it's important to remember.
You normally put the slave on the master on the end and the slave in the middle.
Exactly.
But it'll
also
depend on the jumper setting. It also depends on the jumper setting, because if you've got the jumper setting on cable select, that's when the cable, you know, that's when you can actually have it on the end for the master and the slave in the middle. But if you've actually set the jumper so that it's master and slave on the actual drives, then it doesn't matter where it is, because then the jumpers take preference over it.
That's good to know, Dina, because the curriculum actually doesn't make that clear at all. As a general rule of thumb, the curriculum says that master goes on the end and slave goes on in the middle. Yeah, E?
So I generally set the jumpers, because sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, so you're better off. Also, if you've got it in the middle of the cable, you're always better setting it to slave, I've found, it as a general rule.
And you need to align the pins up, so pin 1 on this connector aligns with pin 1 on the cable, and it says here that it's usually closest to the power connector on the drive. Okay, now sticking with the older machine here, before we go to easy starter, yes?
I think the one thing is, I'm not sure how many people have actually seen what the jumpers actually look like and how to actually figure that out.
I think we decided most people wouldn't need to worry about that too much. We have the experience of doing it, but if you're connecting up modern machines, which is what you'll be doing mostly, I mean, if you're doing it, if this for an exercise, you may come across an older machine. But yeah, okay. How do you figure out jumpers as a blind person?
You get your friendly neighbourhood sighted person to read the diagram off the top of off the top of the hard drive, basically. Or you do what Will does, and then he gets to know
the simplest
general types of hard drives.
Okay, the simplest method, and this seems to work always. If you turn the drive back to front so that the connectors are facing you, then always you've got your PATA cable on the right-hand side, and immediately to the left of that is your jumper settings, and they generally, you'll find there's three groups of two pins in there. They're very, very small, and starting from the extreme right, it's normally master, and the middle is slave, and the extreme left is cable select.
Right, and I use my fingernails for that, because it's hard to do it with a tweezer. When you're blind, you can't really feel. So the best way you can feel it with your fingernails, because the jumper is actually very, very small, square.
Yeah, they're very small. Too small for this girl, I'm afraid. But well, thanks for that, both of you. That's actually quite handy to know if you're working with an older machine. Okay, so basically you plug the one end goes into the motherboard and the other end goes into the drive. That's pretty self-explanatory, really. Now, if we were connecting a floppy drive, there's a little trick to remember, and it's an oft-repeated question that comes up again and again using in the exam. The data cable is a 34-pin one, and one end goes into the motherboard again, and the other two connectors go into the drives. one into the A drive, one into the B drive, if you were having a B drive. But hey, who has those in modern machines? Now, pin 1 indicator on the cable aligns to the pin 1 indicator on the drive connector. Yep.
I still have a 5 1/4 inch floppy drive lying around here, actually, which came out of a very old machine of mine.
The only other place I've seen the 5 1/4 inch still in use is in a Yamaha disc clavier. They're a piano that has an ordinary acoustic piano, but that has the ability to record a song, and they do it on the 5 1/4 inch drive. So that's the only other time I've actually seen them still working. Now, you have to, if you don't, if pin 1 on the floppy drive data cable is not aligned with pin 1 on the drive connector, the floppy drive does not function. This misalignment does not damage the drive, but the drive activity light displays continuously. That is a test alert. So if you misalign the pins on the floppy drive data cable, it doesn't damage the drive, but the drive activity light will be on continuously. To fix this problem, turn off the computer and reconnect the data cable so that pin 1 on the cable and pin 1 on the connector are aligned. Reboot the computer. And as I said, it's an oft-repeated exam question. I think it's a question in the Chapter 3 exam, and I think I actually struck it in one of the finals as well. So that's important to remember. That's why I'm making sure to cover these older things, because you do get asked them in the exams. How relevant they are to doing a modern machine is questionable, of course, but you do need to know this stuff because it is in the curriculum, which is why I'm being careful to cover it here. So, again, one end in the motherboard and the other end into the drive, and that goes for any driver using SATA or anything else. And there are diagrams for those who have any vision to use them. Just a minute while I read here. Okay, the side panels. Now, Cisco says we next have to reattach the side panels, but as any tech knows, and I remember Elise and Jackie making this pretty clear last year, and it was in my experience too, it's a bloody hassle to reattach the side panels and go to all that trouble and connect everything up and then find you've made a mistake and have to undo it all again. So just plug the cables in.
I wouldn't be putting the side panels on until I knew everything worked.
That's exactly right, but Cisco tell you to do it. Sorry, you wouldn't bother. You just make sure your hands are out of the case, and when you felt ready, you turn it on. Connection peripherals.
Anyway, it's quicker to put out the fire once.
Yeah, that's it. Once the fire starts, refer to Chapter 2 for your correct safety procedure stuff.
Yes, Dina.
They only do it for safety reasons, actually, but I've never even closed the machine while working on it.
Yeah, so the world is not going to end if you don't do this. But we'll be good Cisco people, and for the purposes of this lecture, we'll do it their way, because, hey, we're so good that nothing's going to go wrong, is it? You know, we've done really well here, and everything is going to be absolutely hunky-dory.
It's all about political correctness.
Gone mad.
Okay, reattaching the side panels can involve screws, or in the Lee and Lee case, it's probably going to involve just thumb tools, because Lee and Lee cases tend to be increasingly toolless. Even this one here is 6.5 years old. This is a Lee and Lee, and it's got very few screws in it. So it's a matter of just putting the right thumb bolts back into the right slots and attaching the panels. Okay, again, some cases have one three-sided cover that slides down over the whole case frame. Of course, you have to make sure that it's secured at all screw locations. And again, it says it talks about some cases being screwed with screwdriver as another with knobs. And consult the computer. Yeah, they are wonderful. Thumb screws are great. This type of thumb screw, anyway.
We won't tell them about Yvonne's case, hey Kay?
Oh, actually, yes, there's time to do that, because I think I've never come across it before. Go ahead, E.
Well, most cases, as Kylie's just said about, has either one screw at the top to put the top on, or, you know, two on each side, or now we're moving to where you've got those thumb screws, thumb bolts that you can undo, which is really cool, because that's what my case is, so it's not very hard to get it apart, which is what my auntie's case had on one side. That was the side of the computer, whereupon, that shows you the processor side, in other words, the the component side of the motherboard, the left-hand side of the computer, and it had two thumb screws. And I'm thinking, you beauty, I'll get this apart very, very quickly and easily. And on the other side, because I needed to pull out a hard drive, didn't I? So I wanted to have access to both sides of the case. I thought, well, that must be a Phillips head screw. I didn't really pay much attention. And no, it was a pop rivet, so I couldn't get into it.
Oh, boy.
Yep, so the bozos who made that case should be taken out and shot for a start, and the people who sold it to us should be also taken out and shot. So I was at this dilemma. Kylie was on Skype with me that day, as was Kim and a few others, and we're going, how do we get this hard drive out? Because I wanted to do a data recovery, and I wanted to do some other work on the machine, and it turned out that Narissa's husband from the other course, Ian, or Narissa's from our discovery course, her husband Ian, my uncle Ian, and I were looking at it later that night, and we decided the only way we're going to get this hard drive out was to take apart the drive bays. Ugh.
I don't know if this is not acceptable. Oh, can you drill out the pop rivet?
Oh, you should have heard my Uncle Ian. He was, oh, imagine what would happen if this was in my garage. I'd make a mess of it. I'd get that apart. I'd drill them out. He was going for it. And I said, yeah, it would be fun to sort of do, wouldn't it? But, yeah, no, we decided to have a bit of a closer look because we thought, well, these idiots who assembled it must have got the damn thing together somehow. How the hell did they do it? Did they actually put the hard drives in, or the optical drive in, and did they put the hard drive in and whatnot, and the card reader in it, and then did they rivet the thing together? No, they actually... there was actually three screws holding so this is a nuisance. There were three screws holding the lower part of the drive bays together. One holding it onto the front of the chassis, another holding it onto the front as well, and I think a third screw holding it onto the drive bay, which was above where the hard drive went. So I took that part of it off, undid those three screws, and then I just slid the hard drive out as you normally would, undoing the screws from the hard drive and moving the drive back to come out of the bay. So, of course, if I actually wanted to get to a drive that is at the top, i.e. the optical drive, I would have to probably pull two more bays out to get there. Ugh.
Not a very recommended case.
I've seen cases where you actually take the whole drive bay out just to be able to work on the drives. My brother's got one of them.
We wondered if that's what we might have to do there too, but we chose to do this option. Yeah, but you're so right.
What I might mention before going on to connecting external cables is now that we've got our internal cables all connected, it might be a good idea to tie them up. In this machine, the cables are all nicely tied and out of the way so that if you have to get your hands in there for any reason, you don't have to negotiate a snarl of cables all over the place. So that probably is a good thing to have in your toolkit as well, cable ties, so that those internals are all nice and neat and tidy. That's just one thing to be aware of that also isn't in the curriculum, but it makes it a whole lot easier to work if you've got your cables all nice and neat. Okay, external cables can include things like monitors. Now, people, what are our different monitor cables that we could connect?
SVGA and so.
Oh, what are we talking about? Digital analog?
Both. We have, there are three as far as that I've got in my head at the moment. Which three types are they?
HDMI, DVI, and VGA, and SVDO for those who are interested. 2, 4.
SVDO is really, really old, though, isn't it? You don't see many SVDOs really anymore. Yes. Okay. In most cases, it's stick the cable in the connector and tighten the screws, or at least with VGA ones anyway. But on our Dream Machine, we're connecting an HDMI because we can. Okay. Now, other cables. If you want to use an older keyboard or mouse, you might be using what sort of cable, folks?
PS2.
Yeah.
PS2.
I favour PS2. They're a nice keyed connector, and I just like them. You can actually get a USB to two PS2 adapter if you really, really want to. So one end of it's got a USB plug on it, and the other one's got your purple and your green PS2s for your keyboard and your mouse. And just be aware that they are colour-coded, and again, I can never remember which is which. If you want to remind us, you pointed it out in first lecture, I believe.
Sorry, Carl, I missed that. What was that? Oh, the colours. Yes, okay, the PS2 connectors look, well, they are exactly the same for keyboard and mouse. One is purple and the other is green. And how to remember them? I'm glad you asked. The keyboard's pink.
Because a mouse eats green cheese.
And that's it, the moon is full of green cheese, and a mouse eats what? Cheese. So therefore, the mouse is a green connector.
Okay, of course, if you're using USB, that doesn't apply. And in this day and age, then people most likely would use USB or even wireless. So in the modern machine we're doing here, yes, it would probably be USB. Right. Yeah.
Question. Are they labeled on the computer with a picture?
Oh, I think they are actually. Usually, generally speaking, if you've got a computer that's standing upright, and you plug your keyboard into outside of the machine, you're doing the right thing. And if you're plugging your mouse into the one that's more towards the centre of the machine, you're also doing the right thing.
Of course, there's also the network cable, which is a what, people? We're plugging that in because we want connection to the internet.
NIC.
It depends if it's an Ethernet.
Yeah, it's probably going to be an Ethernet, by and large, I would think, in this day and age, anyway.
RJ45.
Yep, exactly. So that goes into the appropriate port.
For registered jack.
Yes. And if we were going to plug a wireless, if we had a wireless NIC on this machine, we would plug the antenna cable in as well. And the last thing that we connect up after plugging all our USB and other cables in is the power cable. So now that we're all connected, we need to turn on and boot the computer for the first time. How exciting. Right, and at this point we have no operating system installed, so it's going to tell us that it can't find one. But when the computer is booted, the basic input-output system, BIOS, performs a check on all the internal components. This check is called a power-on self-test post, POST, and there will be questions in the exam on post and when you press the key. Actually, it's during post. Now, post checks to see that all of the hardware in the computer is operating correctly. If a device is malfunctioning, an error or a beep code alerts the technician that there is a problem. Remember, we're not using an operating system at this point, so there's nothing to pop up on the screen. So the only way that you can know is by those beep codes. Typically, a single beep denotes the computer is functioning properly, and that happens on this old machine. I'm not quite sure it happens so much on newer ones, but this old machine gives a nice, satisfying, comforting single beep whenever I turn it on, and hopefully there it will for a while yet. Now, if there's a hardware problem, it might emit a series of beeps, and each BIOS manufacturer uses different codes to indicate the hardware problems. Look at figure 1 in the section, which is, let me just go back and see, it's 3 point...
That list of beep codes?
Yep.
There was 12 of them or something.
I can't hear anybody.
Hello, anybody out there?
Yeah, I'm here still.
Kylie, you have a green light and no audio. Please check.
Yes, I'm here.
You are now.
That's fine. I'm just reading ahead. That's okay. Don't panic. Okay, now, to get into the BIOS, there are various key combinations that we need to use. Usually it's the delete key, but it can be F8, it can be all kinds of keys. And they are listed in your notes, all the different key combinations that it could be.
I've seen F2 and F1 as well.
Yeah, there are heaps of different ones. Now, once you're in there, you can configure the settings for the hardware devices on your computer. And the configuration data is saved to a special memory chip called a complementary metal oxide semiconductor, CMOS. And there's a diagram for any of those who have vision on that. And the CMOS is maintained by a little button battery in the computer. And if this battery dies, all the BIOS setup configuration data will be lost. So that's how your computer maintains its clock and other functions with a CMOS. And you can tell one of the indicators that your CMOS battery is failing is that if your computer no longer keeps time. And you need to, if the battery dies, you need to replace the battery and reconfigure all your BIOS settings. What fun, because for a blind person, well, there's no speech because we're not high enough up in the system to use any applications yet. Okay, as I said, most computers use the delete key to get in, but you press it during post. Now that's another test alert, so remember that. Okay, and you can fiddle with them.
I've actually seen where people have password protected their BIOS, and that can be a real nuisance when they don't remember their password to actually get in. But a trick around that is remove the battery and leave it out for about an hour, and then plug it back in, and voila, it's actually forgotten its password, so then you can get in.
I think it's best not to password that, and actually there's a lab that you can download from the audio lab recordings under our class name, IT Essentials, that was done back at CAVI. I think it might have been as late as last year. It's a very good lab on everything you possibly want to know about BIOS, and it discusses this very thing, Dina. So I would suggest that everybody downloads that lab because it will enable you to do the final worksheet in Chapter 3. By listening to that lab, you should be able to answer the questions, although you can't do it in your own computer unless you've got sighted help, and if you do, then go ahead and do that. But if you don't, then listen to the lab and answer the questions on the worksheet, because everything, the lab is very comprehensive, so you should be able to answer the questions from that lab if you don't have access to actually doing it hands-on.
Just to let people know, that lab was quite a good recording. Kim, Kylie and I went through and evaluated many of the CAVI stuff recordings, and this one was particularly good because it had Kieran Eaton, who is not with CAVI now. He had some sight and some very good usable vision to read with which to read. And he takes us through each of the BIOS screens on an AMI BIOS on a relatively modern machine. And there's a little bit of interjection from Kerry and Grace in the background, just adding and enhancing it with some comments and asking some questions. And Kieran's very good at reading and explaining to vision impaired people, because I've actually met Kieran when I was in Perth, a number of these aspects. And it is a very good lab, and I would really, really encourage people to read it. That's the Toastmaster advice anyway, because I'm a Toastmaster.
So that's in the recordings of last year's labs.
That's under audio lab recordings. They're all kept together.
You'll find that the QCAD server's down at the moment, so you'll have to refer to Kerry's email from last night where he directs people to go to the to the other mirror. Otherwise, I can just quickly throw up a quick Dropbox link for people if they want it.
Mirror site, yeah. It's running off his home setup.
Indeed.
Would it be possible, because I don't want to I sort of think it might overload his machine. He was a bit worried about how much.
Yeah, sure. What I'll do is I'm just doing a little job for a client at the moment in the background, so I'll, by the end of class, have it in the Dropbox, and I'll put a link in the chat for folks for this session, so I will do that directly.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's lab 3.9.2 if anyone's interested, and that is the lab, if you're not going to do hands-on, that you can use to answer the questions in the worksheet. Although if you are doing hands-on, if you've got a handy sighted person with you, you can play with the BIOS in the computer that you are working on at the time, which is kind of what I did. And you can do all kinds of things in there, but one important thing that you can do is change the boot order. Now, that's the order in which the devices are presented, which you can boot from. And on my machine, the boot order, first in the boot order, is the optical drive, because at the time, if I put an installation CD of Windows in here, it would automatically boot up to that. But if it doesn't see the optical drive, it goes directly to the hard drive. Of course, the floppy drive in older machines can also be part of the boot order. And if you put a non-bootable floppy in the floppy drive and try to turn the computer on, nothing will happen. It won't get past post. It just says non-bootable media. So you can change the order by which the operating system will see the media on which it can boot itself. That's one really important part of the BIOS setting. But listen to the lab. It's very comprehensive. Yep.
These days we generally put it to USB sometimes.
Yeah, and there's different manufacturers call it by different names. Some are called boot priority, some are called boot sequence, some are called boot order.
I think in some cases in the lab, for instance, it's called the boot devices menu. So you need to just be aware of the different terminology. But if it's all about boot, it's fiddling with the boot order, or with the order in which the operating system will be presented with media from which it can boot. So, and part of the worksheet is to change the boot order in the BIOS. So what you'll need to do is describe how they did it in the lab, if you're listening to the lab rather than on your own machine. But of course, if you're using your own machine or a machine that you're doing hands-on, this, then you can play with that with a handy-sided person. It's actually quite fun. Okay, and that's...
Question.
Yes?
On the physical machine, I haven't started assembling. I've only done the disassembly. Would it be a good idea, while it's disassembled, to change the battery in that CMOS?
Oh, it's kind of hard to answer. Yes, it depends how old the battery is. Think, yeah.
Yeah, it would, but just remember that you would lose all your CMOS settings, and you'd have to reset up BIOS from scratch again.
Okay, so we've pretty much covered all the material in this chapter. We have now assembled a computer, we have booted it, and the next thing would be to install an operating system, but that isn't covered for another for another couple of chapters. Next week we'll be doing troubleshooting, but let's just go over some of the important concepts in here before we have the quiz. We have got time for the quiz today, folks, yay! Okay, it says here, just in some of the important concepts, that computer cases come in a variety of sizes and configurations. Many of the components of the computer must match the form factor of the case, and you already know this because you've all done 1.4.7 and all done it wonderfully. Okay, the CPU is installed on the motherboard with a heatsink fan assembly. RAM is installed in RAM slots found on the motherboard. Adapter cards are installed in PCI and PCIe expansion slots found on the motherboard, but they're in the case, aren't they? Okay. Hard disk drives are installed in 3.5-inch drive bays located inside the case, and optical drives are installed in 5.25-inch drive bays that may be exam questions too, by the way, that can be accessed from outside the case. Floppy drives are installed in 3.5-inch drive bays that can be accessed from outside the case. Power supply cables are connected to all drives and the motherboard. Internal data cables transfer data to all drives. External cables connect peripheral devices to the computer. So you need to understand the difference here that we're in terminology between internal, external, and peripheral. A peripheral lives completely outside the computer case. Now, beep codes, it's an important thing to remember, signify when hardware malfunctions. So if you've got a beep, if you turn on the computer and there's more than one beep, it's a hardware problem. The BIOS setup program is used to display information about the computer components and allows the user to change system settings. Okay, now, let me just go to the quiz here and we can get started. Are you ready, E, with your end of the quiz?
I have a problem.
Yep.
I forgot where I put it. When did you send it to me? It will be in an email
that's okay.
two days ago, I guess.
Yeah, that's okay. Because I've got Braille here, I can do the credit. Yeah. No, it's probably easier if I don't.
Sorry about that. It's
no worries.
If you want to forward me a quiz again, I know I did. I'll tell me when you think you sent the email. I'll check.
It was yesterday. It was part of class prep. It was in the attachments.
Oh.
But never mind. Let me. Yep. Let me get started here. Has everybody got their chat window open?
Because people.
Yeah. You will need your chat window open to participate in this quiz.
Yep,
okay.
Done.
Okay. Everybody got their chat window? Yes. And
I can credit everybody it anyway, if you want.
Rosanna doesn't have her chat window open, and Paulette doesn't, but that's okay, Paulette. We know you're just sort of relaxing here today. Rosanna, do you want to open your chat window? Tab over
to the chat. How do I do that for sure?
tab to the chat button and press it in your main Ventrilo window. And a window will pop up.
Okay, I have one that says button to activate press space bar. It just says button.
Just tab, it says chat. Tab to the chat button.
Keep tabbing until you find it.
Okay, would it be a comment button? Buttons, but this one
is labeled. No, the chat button.
No, tab
button. It says chat.
Six tabs from the list.
Yeah, but it does tell you it's a chat button.
It's just after the comment button on mine if you tab once.
Yeah. It does say chat.
Okay, I found the quiz.
Cool.
She's got it.
The quiz has been found.
Excellent. Wonderful. Right, and that's where we write our answers to the quiz into that chat window. It's usually a multiple choice answer, so that then you'll press enter afterwards. Okay, are we all ready? Shall I read them out?
So do we press enter after every answer?
Yep.
If you want to send
it. You do.
Yep. Okay, question one. A technician is installing a new power supply in a computer. Which type of power connector should be used to connect a CD-ROM? Now, is it A, Berg, B, Mini-Molex, C, Molex, or D, 20-pin ATX connector? Go now.
Okay, mostly everybody who answered C, you are correct. A Molex connector.
Yep. Remember this curriculum deals with
which is not
old. Okay. No, it can't be an ATX connector. Okay, number two. A technician is installing a new power supply in a computer. Which type of power connector should be used to connect to an ATX motherboard? Is it A, Berg, B, Mini-Molex, C, Molex, or D, 20-pin ATX connector? Go now.
Everybody who answered D, which is the ATX connector, 20-pin one, you are correct.
Excellent. Okay, we are cooking with gas, folks. Yes?
Elise, are my answers coming through?
Let's see. It was John Allen, was it?
John Howison.
Yes, it is. Yes, they're coming through.
Okay. Number three. When installing a new CPU, which item will help maintain even contact and heat distribution between the CPU and heatsink? Is it A, silicon spray, B, graphite paste, C, glue, D, thermal compound? Go now.
I'll go with the glue.
Yeah, stick it down and make it so you can't get it out again. Everybody
some of these answers are very
D,
funny, aren't they?
I know. Everyone answering D, which is thermal compound, you are correct.
Fantastic. Okay. Question four. When installing a CPU again in a ZIF socket, how should the technician align the pins to avoid damage? So if you're installing into a ZIF socket, how do you align the pins to avoid damage? Do you A, is it pin 1 is always aligned with the opposite corner from the base lever? Or is it answer B, pin 1 on the CPU is aligned with pin 1 on the socket? Or C, pin 1 is aligned with the corner closest to the memory? Or D, the removed corner of the CPU is always aligned with the corner opposite pin 1? Does anyone want that question repeated again? It's quite long. Or do you just put your answers in if you don't?
Those who have answered B, which is pin 1 on the socket to pin 1 on the processor, is correct.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Question 5. A technician is installing additional memory in a computer. How can the technician guarantee that the memory is correctly aligned? A, the label on the memory module should always face the CPU. B, a notch in the memory module should be aligned with a notch in the memory slot. C, the arrows on the memory module should be aligned with the arrows on the motherboard slot. Or D, all memory and motherboard slots are color-coded with one red end and one blue end. Go now.
Everyone who's answering B, which is everybody, aligning the notches, you are correct.
I quite like that last answer. It's one of Cisco's funnies. I remember guffawing quite happily doing my exams and coming across some of these really funny answers. It's someone's got an imagination in there anyway. It's kind of cool. Maybe that's just me. Okay, question six.
They're the same writers who write the questions for Millionaire.
There you go.
yeah, probably. Anyway, question six. When mounting a motherboard in a computer case, what is used to prevent the motherboard from touching the bottom of the case? Is it A, standoffs, B, ground vault isolators, C, silicon spray, or D, grounding straps? Go now.
Everybody who answered A, which is standoffs, you are correct.
Excellent. We are so going well. Question seven. When installing multiple drives, what is the name given to the drive that is attached to the middle connector on a PATA cable? And if you get this wrong, any of you, I shall be very disappointed because we covered it twice in the lecture. Okay. A, is it the secondary drive? B, master drive? C, middle drive? D, redundant drive? E, slave drive? Go now.
Everyone answering E, which is the slave drive, you are correct.
Good, I am relieved. Okay. Number eight. When installing adapter cards in a computer, how should a technician properly secure the card? A, install the card and attach it to the expansion slot using thermal paste. B, install the card and attach it to the motherboard using thermal pads. C, install the card and secure it using metal retaining clips located on the expansion slot. Or D, install the card and secure it to the case with a screw. Go now.
Or F, use Kate options and use glue.
It's going to be the Kate option for now, yeah.
Those seriously who got E, which is install the card and secure it with a screw, you are correct.
Yeah, glue is actually would be an interesting proposition.
It's D. Sorry, my apologies. D is correct with installing the card and securing it with a screw. D for Delta. For those listening in recording land.
We're nearly there. Question nine. Which two connectors are used to connect external peripherals? Choose two. We'll have yes, no answers to this because it's just easier to do that way. So what we want is a peripheral, connectors which connect peripherals.
So whenever Kylie reads you one of the options, answer yes or no accordingly.
Yes. First one, EIDE. Is that an external peripheral connector, yes or no?
Everybody answering no for that, you are correct.
How about Molex? Is that an external peripheral connector, yes or no?
Everybody answering no for Molex, you are correct.
What about PATA? Is that an external peripheral connector, yes or no?
Everybody answering no for PATA, you are also correct.
What about PS2? Is that an external peripheral connector, yes or no?
Everybody who answered yes or Y, you are correct. A PS2 connector is for an external peripheral.
What about USB? Is that an external peripheral connector, yes or no?
And everybody answering yes for the USB being external connector is also correct.
Fantastic. That is the end of the quiz, ladies and gentlemen, and the official end of the lecture. We do have a few minutes to go, so has anyone got any questions or points to discuss?
Can I ask...
I just have a little something that I could mention. I was just out of curiosity the other day. I was looking at anti-static wrist straps on eBay. And did you know that you can get the, what they call the wireless or cordless wrist straps, anti-static?
Yes, but they tend not to be as strongly anti-static as those that you plug in. So it really is better to have, in some situations you can use those, but if you're going to do a full computer assembly disassembly, I would recommend the corded type.
Okay, that makes sense. I was wondering about that, if those would be as good.
If you're just reaching into the case for something and you're going to be feeling around, yeah, perhaps you can keep touching a grounding surface, that's fine. But if you're going to do a full, you're going to need full rig for assembly, disassembly. So, yeah, I think the cordless wrist strap actually does have its place. What do more experienced techies feel about that?
Tell you what, I've never used the wrist strap, and neither have I used the thermal. All I tend to do is open the box, stick your hands on the power supply, let all the discharge out, and then you carry on working. Generally, you find it here in South Africa, even if you ask for a wrist strap anywhere at any of the stores, they'll just laugh at you.
We actually saw one for the first time about 3 months ago. Yes, most technicians just rest their hand across the, a part of the case that's unpainted. So if you haven't got a wrist strap, you can still survive. Just don't tell Cisco.
Yeah, in the service centre that I did my hands-on in last year, they were very insistent on having the mats and the wrist straps. So I think if you're working in a commercial environment, you would be asked to use them, and it's always safe to... You always want to be safe than sorry, especially with us if we're doing a lot more touching than the average tech. I certainly would want to use full anti-static rig if I was fiddling around in a machine, just to be safe, because you just never know. Any other questions?
What I was worrying about when I was unsuccessfully trying to get the motherboard back in this computer is how much the motherboard can take in terms of handling.
I think as long as you don't scratch it, you're fine. So, yeah, apart from that, it's a kind of hard one to ask, really. But it's about like how long is a piece of string. Any thoughts, people?
What was the question?
As long as you're not
preparing this recording for
you. Force on it and damaging the board, yeah, it'll handle quite rigorous use anyway.
So the fact that it kept on slipping out of my hand and just landing on its edge probably isn't going to do it that much harm, but if I sort of scratched it with anything or dropped it on the floor, then it might.
Yeah, it depends on, if it lands on its components, it could damage the components, but if it's just landed on the edge, then nah, I don't think you would have done any damage. Yeah, I think that's the other thing, is it depends on how you work as well. You should never be holding it away and letting it fall on the floor.
You'll find, Kate, that sighted technicians do get a little bit nervous about us handling components more than they think we should. So when you do your hands-on, just watch that a bit. But, yes, it's quite, go ahead and do your handling. Just don't use brute force. I think it's a good rule of thumb. Thanks, Dana.
It's like blind people handling when they cook. Sighted people never use their hands on the food, so I equate it with that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Some of them do, actually, but I find American cooks don't, actually, just to digress. But people like Nigella Lawson from Britain like to get their hands in when they're mixing meatballs and mince mixtures because it's a hell of a lot easier. You just dive your clean hands in there and away you go. It's actually quite fun. So there are sighted people who do use their hands, a bit like there are sighted techs who prefer to use the keyboard rather than the mouse, and they do exist, folks. I know a few. They know the benefits of using a keyboard. Yeah, but no, I think you should be fine, Kate. But just be aware that the sighted person you're working with might be a bit more nervous, so you might need to reassure them as well as yourself, which will make the job a bit harder, but just be a little bit aware of that. Any other questions?
I don't think he's going to care. I don't think he's going to care. It's a computer that doesn't work, so that's all right.
Oh, fair enough. That makes it a bit better. This was a working computer I was using, and the techie was a little bit nervous when I did a bit more touching than he thought I should do, although I did have my hand sanitizer on hand, and my hands were nice and as oil-free as they could be anyway. So we got through that all right. But they do get
tell
a bit silly a about that sometimes.
Tell the sightlings to build a bridge and get over it.
Yeah.
They could use some glue.
That sounds extreme to me.
Okay, well, can I say the work that's been coming in has been really excellent. As for this should make it really easy for you to all write a report in about how you assemble a computer. Shouldn't take long at all. As for the BIOS, as I said, use the lab recording that's there to answer the questions if you're not going to do hands-on. Of course, if you can do hands-on, I would strongly recommend you do so. There is really nothing like having that experience, but is there any more questions just before we sign off?
Yeah, where were you going to put that link, Elise?
I'm just doing it now. I'm just may have to put it, announcing it in an email because I don't think it's copied all the way up to my Dropbox yet. Just let me check. Oh, it has. Okay, I can do it in the chat, but I'll also put an announcement out to the announce list because there might be other people in listener land who are just interested to have it. So hang on, the link's coming.
How important is it to have anti-static wrist straps and that stuff? Like, I have a small SS laptop that I got quite a while ago, and it simply does not work. If I would just want to take it apart, you know, as an experience, how important would that be?
Well, if it doesn't work, you don't have to worry. Unless you want to reuse any of those components in a workable machine, so that's really up to you. Here comes the link to the BIOS lab, gang.
I thought I'd like to see if I could rebuild it, you know, maybe when I take the course or when I learn how to do it, you know, find the parts and to match the case.
Yep, although working on a laptop is actually quite a different experience.
I think with a laptop, lots of the components are integrated. There's only a few things that you can change. If it's the motherboard that's gone, then, you know, forget it, throw it away. If it's the LCD gone on it, then, you know, there's nothing you can do about that. It's too expensive to replace. But if it's things like the hard drive and the RAM on it and so on, yeah, you can upgrade that, you can change that. So, yeah, it depends on what... I have had a laptop where I've had to change the keypad on. So, you know, there are some things you can do and some things it's just cheaper to actually buy a new one.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about laptops in Chapter 6 because there are some key differences in terms of components to the desktops, which Dean has just pointed out. So, yeah, I would always recommend that for this chapter that you find a desktop to work on if you're going to work on hands-on, because working on a laptop is quite a different experience. Yeah, but it's... If you want to take the thing apart and see if you can put it together, and it doesn't work, Rosanna, just go for it. Whatever it takes, really. Any more questions? Comments? No? Well, can I say before we sign off that it's been great to have such a panel of experienced techs here to discuss this assembly. We've zoomed through it, but you've all done the disassembly. Well, most of you have done the disassembly work now, so you're all pretty familiar with what went with what. I hope you've enjoyed playing with this dream machine and that you've enjoyed this lab. I certainly have, and as I said, it's been great to have such experienced heads here with me. Thank you very much indeed for coming, everybody.
Thanks, Kylie, for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you.
And just letting people know that link is going out on the announce list right now for those who missed it in the chat screen.
Yep, went well. Thank you.
See you all later.
Yeah, thanks for having me.